Curioso, and welcome back to the Welsh History Podcast, episode 214, Hester Lynch Salisbury, part 3, Love and Literature. Just before Henry Thayil's death, Hester hired the Italian singer Gabriel Piazzi to help educate her girls in music. Almost immediately, she was infatuated with him. Whether it was love or just the fact that he presented a different face than the usual retinue that she had surrounded herself with is hard to tell. However, it was thought that Gabriel had fallen for her first, as they were of similar age and interests, and her ability to speak and read Italian probably impressed him quite a lot. He had, in fact, tried to cheer her up when watching her husband dying, and seemed generally sad and wanting to help care for her well-being, something that obviously stuck with her enough for her to note it in her journal. Even as she mourned the loss of her husband, she denoted that care. By the autumn of 1781, she knew she loved him, this being Gabriel, and hoped to marry him. But scandal at the idea of marrying this non-aristocratic man from a foreign country who happened to be Roman Catholic scandalized her friends and her daughters, who effectively stepped in to try and force her to reconsider. Gabriel himself vowed to give up on his quest to marry Hester and left for Italy in 1782 to return home and to never return to England, and went so far as to return money that had been given to him by Hester, or at least a perception that money had been given to him, and to show that he was not relying on her or someone who was trying to take advantage of the situation. During the year of 1782, another of Hester's daughters passed away, as they once again got very sick, and of course, her friend Dr. Johnson had gotten upset with what he saw as his favorite, Hester, now ignoring him, likely for the fact that he opposed any relationship between Gabriel and Hester. He was, at the death of Henry Thrales, very much opposed to any other relationship that Hester grew into, and certainly was not a tolerant person of respecting her wishes when it came to marrying this man. When she eventually received acceptance from her oldest, Queenie, in November of that year, she called Gabriel back to Britain and married him. Johnson was very nonplussed, stating, "Madam, if I interpret your letter right, you are ignominiously married." That dislike of this situation and of this marriage certainly played havoc to their relationship, and many of her own friends thought that the marriage was a terrible idea and were not shy about sharing their displeasure over Hester marrying, in quotes, down. This was something akin to being unforgivable because you were marrying outside of your class. This could go both ways, as marrying up was not always perceived positively depending on the situation, and would remain a feature of at least upper-class British thought well into the 20th century. Just think of some of the reactions towards any sort of marriage between people for love and the reactions that happened at times in some of the royal marriages that happened in the years past. However, that did not deter Hester, and she and her husband would spend 3 years from 1784 to 1787 traveling around Europe, effectively stepping away from her old friend group and from Johnson in particular, and traveling as she had planned to do for so many years before Henry became sick and was incapable of being able to travel much. It was something that developed a lot of animosity amongst various people, including her daughters, who would definitely not be fully happy with this relationship right up until Gabriel passed away a number of years later. Hester, for her part, wrote off Johnson and told him frankly that as long as he continued to rail against Gabriel, she would not talk to him, something that obviously set the old linguist into fits of rage and insult. Sadly for both of these longtime friends, now bitterly opposed to one another, Samuel Johnson died on December 13, 1784, and you get the sense that Hester was regretting this parting. She would write that he was her inspiration and that she was, in quotes, "in Johnson's intellect, mine was swallowed up and lost," end quote. Because of the loss of Johnson, she set herself a goal to write and document his life, maybe to make amends after a fashion, maybe just as a memorial to the friends that they used to be to one another. She had decided to publish the book, Anecdotes of the Life They Had Together While She Was Traveling. It was a personal biography rather than a discussion of his public presence. It was written to show the great figure of literature both as a great intelligence while also not shying away from his more annoying and grouchier aspects of his life. This was not an expose or a tell-all book, as we would think of it, but also it was not an honorarium, a book built on talking him up as you might some famous person who gets mentioned around the time that they've passed away. You know, the ones where they kind of erase all of their warts and problems and just talk about all the great things they did. As it turned out, this biography was, of course, an instant hit, in part because people likely expected it to be a harsh assessment of Johnson based on the split between the two just the few years previous. However, it wasn't harsh. It was more a truer telling of their life together. And in the first few months, it sold 3,500 copies, and even King George III was said to have read it. From this book, published in 1786, Hester's career exploded. Now not just a simple translator or a writer of occasional published poetry or even a political commentator, now the Welsh heiress was a famous and successful biographer. One thing that remained in all her writings was a conservative political and religious viewpoint, one that was able to see other sides, but not necessarily going to approve of aspects she thought extreme. She opposed the revolution in France and the Jacobins who favored it in her own country. She also saw the absolute monarchists as just as evil. For her, constitutional monarchy was the correct balance to the two extremes as she saw them. One thing Hester was not and could not be was a pro-democracy supporter. Her ideals were firmly based in class consciousness and the idea that Britain's success was built on a meritocracy but controlled by a structure of aristocratic control. Something that seems quite baffling if you think about it, but it's something that we often have points in our lives where we have conflicting ideas about things that make no sense, and certainly this seems to be the case with Hester, and something I struggle with when I read some of her writings and some of the things she had to say. Democracy to late 18th century Britain was a buzzword for the excesses of the French Revolution, and so because it was conflated, the idea of a citizen's voice from the poorest to the wealthy being equal became something considered unworthy of the British government. Bluntly, it was ridiculous, but it served to keep the power structure the same way it had been for over all these years, and as mentioned in previous episodes, went against the radicals who wanted to change the country. The French Revolution was used as a cudgel to break dissent and to create an idea that if you were following this concept of democracy, you were a believer in the French Revolution in all of its ugliness. Nonetheless, as she traveled, Hester wrote and expressed her love for Wales, compared it favorably against most of the places she lived and visited. She would compare North Wales to the views and experiences in Italy and look upon them as very similar, something that likely few Italians and maybe even a few Welsh people would disagree with. Quoting her, "Were I to affirm that the sea is of a more peculiar transparent brightness upon the coasts of North Wales than anywhere else, it would seem prejudice, perhaps. Yet it is strictly true. I am no less persuaded that the sky appears a finer tint in Tuscany than any country I have visited." Due to her fame and continued writing, in 1788 she published a book of letters of Dr. Johnson and replies from herself, probably to fill out the document since she didn't have all of the letters that were written. In fact, her eldest daughter refused to give her any of her own work that she had received from Johnson, in part because she disagreed with some of this confidential inclusion. Then in 1789, she published a travel guide of her trips around Italy, Germany, and France. And on the eve of the Revolution, these two books were both very successful and, as often happened, became a target for those who either disapproved of her writings or hated her success. Her competing biographer, James Boswell, who had also published his own biography of Johnson, as well as a previous discussion of their travels around Scotland, became one of her adversaries and was upset at Hester's more intimate writing, which seemingly were knocking his more formal, structured work, something that he would be at odds with her about for quite a long time afterward. Originally, he published notes of his trips to Scotland with Johnson, and then built on the traditional methods of biographies of the day, which, in those writings, it was well received, but it was fully superseded by Hester's own biography and later letters. It created a small rivalry between the two of them, and both would fire broadsides against each other through their literary comments and force the other to respond to the attacks. Another writer who opposed Hester was William Guildford, who would continue to lash out at Hester and other women who seemed to be either too popular or too controversial in his opinion. He would be very willing to write about Hester as some sort of pompous head of a chattering class of women too addicted to tea and poetry in his ideals. If you're like me and eating healthy is a bit of a problem, let me bend your ear a little bit to eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggies. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfasts, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Also, if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 and use the code WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code WelshHistoryPod50 at factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Eventually, Hester continued to reflect on Wales and the Welsh, even while she wrote about England and Britain as a whole. She fell in love with the histories that were being manufactured about Wales during this time period, and the idea of its early mythological beginnings, which were being formalized. Hester, as so many others, was increasingly influenced by the writings of people like Iolo Marginui and his pseudo-history and building of ancient mythology from whole cloth. She would often write positively during this period about him and about the ideas of finding Welsh settlers in America who intermixed with natives, which was one of the concepts that some of these writers were pushing at the time. For most of her adult life, as we mentioned in the past, Hester spent a lot of time around London, either in the city itself or in the country estates just outside of the city. But in 1792, she began a project with Gabriel to build a whole new building on her Welsh lands. These would be built as a, in quotes, small cottage, end quote, in an area around where her family, the Salisbury estate, was. It was built in a neoclassical style, something that stood out against the decrepit and falling apart Flemish designs that were around the estate at that time period, which were built in the 16th century. They would eventually be torn down in the 1800s as this new building was built. They would call the house Bryn Bella, combining both Welsh and Italian in the naming to create Beautiful Hill. And this Beautiful Hill would be the place where they would continue to grow their life together, and Hester would continue writing as she had done for many years before this. She would complete in this home her anti-French musical called King Killers. Subtlety, of course, was never a strong suit, so thus you can get the idea of what she might be referring to. Most of her life from 1792 to 1800 was spent building this life in Wales and trying to convince her friends and children of its commendable nature, an attempt to use her skill as an author to battle those who supported the revolutionaries both at home and abroad, with her propaganda skills being aimed specifically against French invasion, including a line which I'll just quote here, "But let them shun this hostile shore, or back again we'll bang them, and their tree of liberty a gallows make to hang them," end quote. She would also take on Thomas Paine, who defended the French Revolution during the 1790s, and call for more to be done to oppose him and his ideas around the concepts of the rights of man. She even complained that his pamphlet was being translated into Welsh, and to quote her, "and are supposed to do not so small mischief among the low people hereabouts," end quote. The battle for ideas, both radical and conservative, played out on her mind quite a lot during this period, and she was definitely one of those people who railed against what was considered to be radical democracy. The wealth of her adult life and the aristocratic upbringing she had received had Hester appeared now to be out of touch with what was going on around her. She had become somewhat inoculated against the suffering of the poorer people. Initially, while people suffered under famine and deprivation, she only noticed the situation as it got close to her. Seemingly, the thought of the Welsh poor was that they were too nice to get angry about it. In other words, she just didn't see them as being unkind or rebellious, but rather docile to their plight, something that would come back to haunt her later. However, as time went on and the famine grew, Hester and Gabriel tried their best to be seen as stewards to the poor, offering them food, holding celebrations with their neighbors, and became as important to her to protect these poorer people around her than when she held wealthy and rich, elaborate dinners. As she grew frustrated with how poorly her Welsh neighbors were being treated, she would write about them, especially when compared to some of the English cities and how much they were gaining. To quote her, "Why are the poor so little attended to, I wonder, and their wants so ill supplied? Here is a lovely harvest, and one hears of grain brought in to every port every day. I thought that was only newspaper nonsense. till accounts from Liverpool assured us that there was plenty in their town, end quote. During this period of war, Gabriel suffered from gout so badly that it made him an invalid for months at a time, this happening at the same time while he was quite upset and depressed about the invasion of Italy by Napoleon, and this added to the stress that the family felt all around. The fear of the loss of the old order was playing on Hester's mind and focused a lot of her writings around how bad this was and how it would pull down society, often using the idea of the Liberty Tree as gallows as a way of saying that democracy brings about death. In this same period, her own relationship with her family was deteriorating, with her daughter specifically, to the point where Hester decided that their Welsh house could not be given to them on her death, and instead decided to adopt one of her husband's nephews to the role as heir. This, of course, did not endear her to her family, as you can imagine. Certainly that would be seeming a insult to her surviving children, and they were definitely even more outraged when the boy on arrival was christened John Salisbury Poyatzi after Hester's father. One thing that comes from reading about her life is that Hester did not really spend a lot of time with her children as they grew and were educated, and you're left to wonder at times if that created part of the problem between them. Seemingly, she would travel away from them, going on long trips to Wales or Bath, and in later years to Europe. And in all of this, it doesn't seem to be attended with her children. And I think this is part of the reason why her children were so isolated from her. And I think that this created such separation between both parties, as they had to deal with this fact that their mother didn't really associate with them a whole lot, and if she did, it was usually one or the other side opposing the other, more often than not. Let's be clear that our more sentimental understanding of parenting in our current environment is different than what our ancestors may have felt. I'm not saying that they were generally hard-hearted towards their children, but it would be a lie to say there wasn't a difference between how people were brought up then as opposed to now. But one thing that became clear reading about Hester's life is that her children, as they entered schools, they would generally end up in boarding schools, and it was almost expected that the child was now having a whole new life, and that the education being done with this separation in mind was both expected and encouraged. Far from being at the forefront of raising her children, it seemed more likely that they were on the periphery fairly quickly after they went to school. And if they disagreed with Hester, as Queenie often did in her adult years, there was a disconnect between the parent and child, which I think Hester struggled with. This also may be a result of her own problems with her own parents and the conflicts that they had between them, and how this played out in Hester's experiences with her own girls, and in part creates the problem, I think, that develops around this new boy that they bring in to be the heir to the Welsh lands, because this Italian child that's brought in, their nephew is not remaining at home for long. He's sent off to school to learn English and to learn an education, and he's not being brought in as someone to be added to the family. While he's treated like a family member, it's certainly not in the same way that you would expect, but certainly not uncommon in this period. So it's kind of difficult to sort of unpick where the culture ends and Hester's own discomfort begins on this whole thing, and it creates a lot of conflict between all of the various family members that you see happening often, and that effectively she made her own girls hostile towards her by her attitude, by the idea that because they were fails, they were somehow not the same, or that they didn't deserve the same respect, or maybe because they opposed her relationship, she set up a division against them. It's hard, even reading her journals, it's hard to know how she felt versus how they felt, because you don't get their point of view. And her opposition to their choices in life seems to create part of the problem. And even when she's happy for them later as they get married and have their own children, she seemingly has put up such barriers that she doesn't get invited to weddings. Often there's a conflict between them over names, as one of the children of one of her daughters is also named John Salisbury and has probably more right to this area than a nephew from another marriage. And the conflict it creates sets in place such trouble that she struggles to maintain any sort of relationship with him. And it's probably one of the most difficult parts when you read her life is seeing how her children relate to her and how that creates such trouble amongst them, which, again, it's hard to know how much of this is just her own upbringing being reflected back in this situation. So, with all that said and done, Hester continues to write. As we enter into 1801, she writes her history book called Retrospection. This was first published in 1801, and it is both a summary history as well as a philosophical book, and very similar to most of the history books written in this time period, is emblazoned with mythology and with a Eurocentric viewpoint of a Christian person talking about history. So a lot of things are done in a way to sort of back up what's said in that time period. And because of that, it is different than something that we would necessarily be excited about or use as a source material. But at the time, it was still considered a history book and one that was considered universal because it wasn't just talking about Wales or Britain or any one place, but it was talking from an overall perspective. It was, however, in part because of this, it started to initially sell well, but as reviews started to come out, the entire book tanked, so much so that unlike many of her other books, there was never a second printing. The London Review specifically said of the book, quote, "Female vanity never set itself forth more conspicuously, not more absurdly, than in the assumption of a universal knowledge which runs through the whole compilation," end quote. It is just one of many reviews where the idea of a universal history written by a female was something to be despised, or at least to be ridiculed. The book's attempt to be a universal history book, which covered so much of European history, specifically, according to Professor Franklin, whose book I have used for these last three episodes quite extensively, was seen as a bastion of male writers and not something that females should be taking up. And he suggested that this is why this book failed miserably, especially as reviews were particularly hostile to it, and above so many other things Hester had written, which had been much more positively received. In 1809, Gabriel, who had slowly had debilitating arthritis and pain wreaking havoc to his body, passed away. And after his death, Hester realized her own mortality was approaching and began to make preparations to protect her family, including building up a legacy of her own teenage nephew, who was now becoming her heir, in quotes, and the writings that she had made over the years, collating them for publication at some point. She eventually passed away, having outlived the hated French Revolution, dying in 1821 in Clifton, still mostly estranged from her daughters, and with a nephew who, if we were being generous, could be described as a bit too rich for his own good. He had become spoiled by the generosity and absence of his aunt and uncle in his life, and seemingly unconcerned about her well-being when she passed away, and certainly was not perceived kindly by his adopted family. That would be something of a legacy for all of them to deal with, and certainly in the future, that has always been the issue between Hester. It's the balance of her writings, which are important as one of our first major nonfiction female authors, especially a Welsh one, to come around this time period, but yet measured against someone who has a very difficult family upbringing and a difficult family of her own, which you can look at and measure against. But this is a problem for anybody in history. It doesn't matter who you are. There's going to be sides of your character that are not positive. And certainly opinions in ages past were not always considered kind of thing that we would talk about now. Ideas about race, about culture, about society of the late 18th century are not what we look at today in modern culture. The ideas of democracy, the ideas of class structure, the ideas around different societies has changed dramatically. So people like Hester are out of place when you look at them in this context. But within this context, you have someone who, in a world where all of this kind of goes against you, fought for her own standard to write and document and fight against the ideas that women could not do this, that women could not be politically active, that women could not be a part of the discussion, that somehow they should only write children's books and love stories and novels and not actually get into the heavier things that society brings and talks about. This was something that Hester was desperate to try and do more of. And if we were to look at the positives of her life, that is one we will take away. Amongst all the other things that we may disagree with or dislike, that is something we should not forget or not consider when we look at what we're talking about. And I think we're lucky to have this person as someone who not only was a prolific author, but also a journalist who kept her own diaries and made sure that her own opinions were known over the years so that we didn't lose everything when she passed away other than what she wrote publicly, something that would happen quite frequently with a lot of people. One thing from reading this was learning that quite often if somebody was writing journals, they would get burned at the end of their life when they died rather than kept, which is appalling, but it's something that would definitely be the norm. And that biographies of people was not supposed to talk about their personal life. It wasn't supposed to be about, you know, their lifestyle or their upbringing or things that we would just see as normal in a biography. These things were to be kept private and to be kept away from public discourse, something, of course, that would change quite dramatically over the years after this. So as I said, I myself am grateful for what she did in sort of documenting not only her own life, but also documenting her relationships and how they molded her into who she was. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach me at thewelshhistorypodcast@gmail.com. If you want, you can give us a follow on Twitter at Welsh History Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/Welsh History Podcast. Or if you are so inclined, you can help out this podcast with purchases of materials through Patreon at patreon.com/Welsh History. You are by no means obligated to do so, but I appreciate everyone who does. And without you, I certainly wouldn't have as good of a podcast as I feel that I'm able to put forward right now. Thank you, everyone. Take care. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Welsh History Podcast is a member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To find more information on them, you can do so at evergreenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5-Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.